think about this from time to time. You know, you see it in the Olympics. It happens. Someone becomes an overnight sensation, and long-term fans, like, come out of the woodwork. Last year, the Texas Rangers, who I have followed since I was a little kid and have never been any good, were suddenly good and actually won the World Series. And it was crazy how many people were Texas Rangers fans. They're called bandwagon fans. They come out of nowhere, and those of us who were longtime real fans kind of look down our noses at them because they're Johnny-come-latelys, you know. They want to be a part of something that's successful. What is it about us that makes us jump on bandwagons? And I have to admit, I've done it too. Is it that we want to associate ourselves with glory and honor of others? Is it that we want to feel some of their success ourselves, or to have others connect the success of our team with us? When our team is winning, we wear their colors, we wear their hats, all that stuff. When our team is the worst team in the league, do we still wear their colors and their hats? What's that all about? I think we're all naturally driven by the need to feel significant, to really be somebody. No matter how tall or short or wide or thin or extroverted or introverted, all of us want to feel significant and have other people regard us as significant. You may have noticed some people actually buy jerseys with another person's name and number on them. And the more successful that player, the more jerseys they sell. And I guess we want to wear the player's name so that we can feel more personally connected to their success. But I think we'd all agree, however, that it'd be much better to have people clamoring to own jerseys with our own name and number on them. To have a name that people look up to and admire. Achieving a good name is important to all of us. In our text this week, we're looking at Genesis 11 and 12. We find two very different ways to obtain a great name. It portrays two radically different ways of life, and we must choose between them. We may not know we have to make the choice, but we probably already have made the choice. And there's something that speaks to all of us here, regardless of our name. These events take place at a time when the world is in total chaos. Evil that cannot repair itself, fix itself, dominates everything. God's very good creation has now been spoiled by human desires and ambitions. Adam and Eve's sin in the garden is followed by one story of crime and punishment after another. Then the next thing that happens is their first son, Cain, murders their second son, Abel. And from that inauspicious beginning, sin spreads throughout the whole of humanity till it reaches this point in Genesis 6, 5, and 6. The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. And so we've been preaching on this, on Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel, and then the world washed clean in the flood, and then the Tower of Babel last week that Jeff led us in that sermon. God decides that he's just going to have to wash away all the filth of the world and get a clean start with the only righteous man left on the face of the earth, Noah. Yet even after the flood, nothing really improves. Human society starts all over again after the flood and becomes very clear very quickly that humans are going to defy God all over again. The first thing you know, Noah gets drunk, his children shame him, he curses some of his offspring, and then we have the movement to the plains of Shinar. God had made it clear in creation that he wanted humans to scatter across the whole creation, the whole earth. Genesis 1:28, he said, "Be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it." And after the flood in Genesis 9, God again tells them, "Fill the earth." But the humans refused to follow God's plan. Like Adam and Eve, they rejected God's vision in order to follow their own vision of what's best for their lives. So they hang together and they build a great city of their own with a great tower, the world's first skyscraper. And the express reason they say they want to do this is what? Genesis 11, verse 4. So that we will make a name for ourselves. We will be significant. They want to become great. They want to build a lasting reputation. They want to build something here in Shinar that is solid and stable and secure, something impressive, something that future generations will gawk at in amazement at what they accomplished. They want to build a great world of their own. Genesis tells how God came down to the earth to see this city and tower. It's like it was too tiny and insignificant to even be seen from heaven. He had to come way down to see it, get a look at it, and he's not impressed. He knows that because of the evil of their hearts, the only great thing they will do is sin. And because they refuse to fulfill his goodwill for them to scatter across the earth, he has to compel them to scatter across the earth. So he mixes up their languages so they can't communicate with each other, which leads to a world like the world we know. A world where people are scattered all about, separated into little tribes and states and nations in competition and conflict with each other. And if you're reading this story for the very first time or hearing this story for the very first time, if you can imagine that, the very first time, you're starting to feel a great deal of tension because it's becoming apparent by this point in the story that the human problem, the problem of sin, all the murder and rape and child abuse and enslavement and all those things, the problem of human sin is great, that so great that it threatens God's entire creation and there's no apparent way to fix it. When humans continually revert to the same sins for the same reasons, when they refuse God's will and build the Tower of Babel even after the flood, it's becoming apparent that this world will not be fixed by punishing it. You can ratchet up the punishment all you want to, but it will still not solve the human problem. It will take something other than punishment and destruction to save this world. So what can God do if he isn't just going to give up on his whole project, give up on all these people? That's where the call of Abraham comes in stark contrast to the desire of the citizens of Shinar to make a name for themselves. God comes to Abram and offers to give him a great name. He says in Genesis 12, verse 2, I will make your name great. Now, at this point, there's nothing special about Abram. The only thing that distinguishes him and his wife Sarah is that they're cursed with infertility. They can't seem to have children together. And from the perspective of their time, because they cannot have children, they'd have no future. Their names will die with them within a couple of generations. Even their graves will be forgotten. No stories will be told of them. Nobody will keep their memory alive. They will vanish from the earth, and it'll be as if they never existed because they have no children, no future generations. Abraham's journey from Ur of the Chaldees to the place God called him to doesn't take place all at once. It kind of happens in stages. Abram first moves with his father Terah and his nephew Lot from Ur to Haran. The same culture and language, not that big a stretch for them. And he stays there until his father dies. And only then does he embrace the call of God and do something radical, something frightening, scary. He leaves home and heads out on a dream based on a promise from God that he doesn't really know, a God he doesn't really know. A God he hasn't grown up with. There's no scriptures that he can go to learn about him. This is just a God who appears to him and makes a promise. And Abram and Sarah must wonder now who will take care of them. Abram's already 75 years old. Sarah is 65. They have no children. And they are leaving their land and going to a place where they don't know the language and the customs and nobody knows them. Where they have no relatives, nobody to protect them from the local population. This is a movement away from security into a strange and dangerous country. They would not have done it at all if what they were looking for at this stage in their lives was comfort. If they were looking for comfort, they would have never made this trip. Even in the promises God makes, it's clear that He's calling them to live not just for their own interests, but also for others. Even considering the promise of land, He promises to give them land. What good is that if you have nobody to pass it on to? He says to them in Genesis 12, 2 and 3, you will be a blessing. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. They're called to be a blessing to this fractured world of many nations where nobody listens to each other. And yet they head off without a map, living in a tent, never owning any property until Sarah dies and they buy a grave spot for her. According to Hebrews 11, verse 13, all these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on earth. Have you ever admitted to yourself that you're a foreigner and a stranger on earth? That's what they did. God says Abram through Sarah will be the father of a great nation. But he and Sarah wind up having just one son. Other than a few hints here and there, they see very little evidence in their lifetime that the promises of God will ever become a reality. Yet in this small way, God begins the salvation of the whole world, of all creation, through one family willing to trust Him to make their name great, instead of trying to build something in order to make a great name for themselves. And God led Abram to the crossroads of all civilization. If you look at a map of the ancient world civilization, you see the great Egypt and the pyramids and all of this great civilization. And you see over here, you see the area of Babylon, of the Tigris and Euphrates and the great civilizations that arose in that area. And the road from Egypt to Babylon goes through what? Jerusalem. Goes right through. It's the crossroads of all civilization where all nations could be impacted by his descendants. And that's exactly what happened. But to understand the story of Shinar and the Tower of Babel and the story of the call of Abram, we need to see them together as they're set side by side in the biblical text. Because these stories represent clearly divergent paths that are set before every one of us and a choice that each one of us will have to make. A choice we're making. Are we going to follow the logic of Babel? Are we going to follow the logic of Abram? These stories present us with the fundamental choice of, on the one hand, living to build a great life for ourselves, a great name for ourselves, a great career, a great reputation, or on the other hand, to choose to follow God on an occasionally frightening and often surprising journey that results in blessings to others. In New Testament terms, it would be a call to discipleship. God promises to make us great if we will relinquish control of our dreams and visions, stop trying to become something great due to our own efforts and accomplishments, and instead to follow Him in His vision for the world and for our lives. Now, this isn't easy. Following God is a frightening prospect because it means letting go of things, things that give us a sense of security and identity. It means walking by faith, not by sight. For Abraham, it meant leaving his own country and his own relatives, his own town, all of that, leaving that permanently. And living for God in our day may mean that we have to miss out on what the world would consider great opportunities. And that sounds scary. But God reminds us, if we listen to Him, that the most dangerous path we could choose is to follow our own plan for success, for greatness. Proverbs 19:21, many are the plans in a person's heart, but it is the Lord's purpose that prevails. And Psalm 127, verse 1, unless the Lord builds the house, the builders labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the guards stand watch in vain. You can choose the path and logic of Babel. You're going to build a great career, a great home, a great name and legacy for yourself. But if the Lord doesn't build that, your work is futile. As the wise man said, it's just the wind blowing. There's nothing substantial there. Ecclesiastes 2, 4 through 11. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labor. This was the reward for all my toil. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless. A chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. No matter what your plans are, it is the Lord's purpose that will prevail. We can't really live for personal security and reputation and follow God's call as disciples of Jesus working for God's kingdom. And the choice between these two ways of life impacts how we view ourselves everywhere we go. For example, think about your workplace. Why are you there? How do you see yourself there? You go to this place every day to build something for yourself, or to go this place to build something that will be a blessing, to be God's blessing there as an agent of God's peace, of reconciliation, of God's love. Is that why you go where you go to work? Do you go there as an agent of self-promotion? Are you conscious of that, of what your presence in the workplace means for the others around you, or are you just building a tower to secure your future? What about an education? When you make the effort to get an education, are you preparing yourself to serve others, or are you just seeking to feather your own nest to increase your earning potential? Why get an education? Why did you choose to live where you live, in this city, in this area? Was it because of opportunities for building a name for yourself? Was it because this is the most comfortable, secure place for you, where your family is? We have people to support you here. Was it because this is the most comfortable, secure place, or do you feel called by God to be a blessing here? Is that why you're here? To serve the mission of God? How do you choose the neighborhood you live in? Is there anything beyond self-interest in that decision? Anything beyond self-interest. Why have children? Is it to make your life more complete? Is it to make yourself feel loved? Is it to make a lasting name for yourself? Or do we have children as an expression of God's love and an extension of our love for each other, and to teach them to embrace his call and become a blessing to the world? You know, Connie and I really love having our adult children and grandchildren here in Louisville and here in church. It's wonderful. That's not something I ever experienced before. We never lived near one of my grandparents when I was growing up, so we're very grateful to have that. But it's even more important to us that our children listen to God's call to serve him by serving others, which they are, whether that's here in Louisville or far away. My parents made that decision. That's why they moved away from home and went wherever the Lord called them, even as far as Africa, and left home and city and family and safety and security and embraced that call. I grew up in a home like that. And I love the fact that this church is sending people to. Some of your children have made those same choices because they believe God is calling them to go somewhere else to share his blessings. Why do you attend this church or any particular church? Does it all have to do with which church I believe fulfills the needs and desires of me and my family the best? Or even more cynically, do I choose a successful church for the same reasons that I jump on a team's bandwagon when they're winning? Because it appears successful and I want to be associated with that. I want to appear successful. Do I choose a church based, this is even more cynical, choose a church based on the networking potential there for furthering my career? Is it a financial decision? Or do we attend worship and come a part of a church because we believe that church has adopted God's mission as its own, and we want to be a part of what God is doing there? Because we want to exercise the gifts that God has given us in service to a cause greater than ourselves. Not because we want to make a name for ourselves, but because we want to glorify God's name in service and in worship. And why is the church here? Why is Westport Road Church of Christ here? Is it to serve itself or to serve the city? Is it our purpose to make all of our members feel comfortable and happy? Or is it our purpose to follow the call of God wherever that leads us? To train and equip our members to become ministers. Which of these priorities best reflects the logic of Babel? And which reflects the logic of Abram? Or should I say, best reflects the name Church of Christ? God wants you to really be somebody. Somebody like Noah or Abraham or Hannah or Moses or Esther or David or Ruth or Peter or Lydia or Barnabas or any one of the hundreds of shining examples of people who chose to follow the logic of Abram rather than the logic of Babel. When God called, they answered. And that's your choice this morning too. Be somebody. God is calling.